So for those who are just joining us this year for the first time, our group meets here in this building, which is focused on remembering the Holocaust and everything that goes with that to the extent that's possible in such a magnitude. And we are focused in this group on the spiritual resistance, on the religious life of Jews during the Holocaust. And that has multiple levels of application for different people. So for those who are giving tours, so over the years some people have taken pieces of this experience and put it into their tours. For those who are volunteers, it means having this perspective when you welcome people. And for those who are none of the above and are just enhancing our knowledge of this topic, the goal is that we should become more familiar and appreciate what exactly this spiritual resistance in the form of religious life look like. It is a challenge for me because, as we've talked about in the past, when we open up this book that we call The Holocaust, this chapter, it's incredibly emotionally taxing, as everyone here knows, and it's very challenging. It's also challenging in the sense of, well, how much more are we learning? To what end are we learning? So on one level, we're learning because we need to continue to fill out this academic knowledge. But for me, there's something else that drives why we're going to get together and have this study group. And that is because what we're talking about in this group is not a historical experience. It is a living experience. Meaning, the religious life that we have and continue to talk about is not just one that is rarefied in a glass case. It informs the lives of so many people today around the world, Jews all over, irrespective of what your particular set of practices are. It can enrich the Jewish lives that we live on a day-to-day basis. And that's ultimately the transcendent hope with this. So today we're going to study a particular topic. And this particular topic fits into, of course, the broader context that we've been studying. And for those who are just joining us, you will not have missed a beat. It's going to start from scratch. Every session is independent. But the context, the goal is that we should enrich ourselves in a holistic manner, whether we are from one background, Jewish, different background, not Jewish, observant, not observant, but appreciating the inspiring life that was lived can inform us on a day-to-day basis. So today's topic we're going to call Keeping Jewish Time in the Holocaust. This is going to be the first of a two-part discussion. Each one is independent. Today we're going to talk about calendar in general. And then, please God, there was an email that went around, and we'll send it around again. There is a sign-up sheet, so we'll make sure that you get the information. Our next class, Mirtz Hashem, is December, then February, April, June. You'll get the whole list just to make sure. But the next class, we're going to talk about a specific calendar issue. Why are we talking about calendar now? Why is now a good time to talk about the calendar? Because we just reset the calendar with Rosh Hashanah, with the Jewish New Year, and if you look, many of the sources and materials that we're going to have today come from Yad Vashem. Well, when you look at the Yad Vashem kind of Rosh Hashanah collection, they focus on the idea of calendars. I thought that would be a great idea. And then the second component of this, which is really a fascinating discussion, upstairs, after the turn to the left, when you go past the death camp exhibit, there's a little rescuers exhibit, right, on the left-hand side. So Sugi Hara is mentioned in that exhibit, and there is a much broader episode there of religious Jews, the Mir Yeshiva, traveling to Shanghai in the Far East. Well, that episode of the Mir Yeshiva and Jews traveling to Shanghai raised a fascinating calendar question. Fascinating calendar question, which is what we're going to talk about next time in December. What day is Yom Kippur on the calendar? Because at a certain point, you encounter what we call the international dateline. Well, for Jews, when we have our own calendar, what does the international dateline look like? And when would you observe Yom Kippur? Would you observe Yom Kippur on day A, on day B, on both days? So that's going to be the second half. But today, we're going to focus on the calendar in general. Let's start just with a general observation, and that is that time is precious. Time is the most precious commodity that the Ribbono Shel Olam, that God gave us on this earth. And so how we use our time is very important, but also how we mark time is very interesting. So if we turn out the lights for a second, thank you, Mickey, we're going to take a look here. I want to move to slide number one. Let's go back to the beginning. Let's start. Where are we? Here we go. Let's start with this slide, which is a traditional contemporary Jewish calendar, October 2018. So what do you have on this calendar? For those who can't see it on the far wall, I'll turn it to you on the small screen. So what you see here on this calendar is first the English month. It's written in English, but if you were writing a calendar in Germany, you would write the calendar in German, as we'll see. You see it has the days of the week, and underneath them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, which on your screen, you have the little arrow, if you can, if I can find the arrow. There it is, hello. There you see the number 3, next to that the number 2. But in small letters, this you can print at home if you wanted to make your own Jewish calendar. This says a Hebrew date. So for example, today's date, which is October 10th, the tiny letters say number 1, Cheshvan, the first day of Cheshvan. So you have the English month and the Hebrew date. What's the difference between the English and the Hebrew? The Hebrew calendar works based on the moon, the lunar calendar, exactly, which is why this year, because we've had several the consecutive months of 354-day lunar cycles, the year is going to start falling behind, so we add an extra month at the end of the Jewish cycle, which is the second month of Adar, to fill us in, so that Pesach always stays in the spring. So you notice also, on the side of this Jewish calendar, there's a tiny little thing, it's hard to see a little bit, what could you imagine is on that column? That's right, candle lighting. So a lot of, this is a generic calendar, so you won't have it for Chicago, but a lot of Jewish calendars are going to have your Friday night candle lighting time. And then, on the right-hand column, all the way on the bottom, it says, in this case, this week, it says Noach. On the 13th, it says Noach. Right, the Seder of the week. In shul, in synagogue, what are they going to read? What Torah portion are they going to read this week? It's going to be the Torah portion of Noach. So this is a traditional calendar with which we are familiar. Lights, please. That sounds very awesome. So what would happen if we had the opportunity to open a window into another Jewish calendar at another time? It would tell us a lot of things. It would tell us about the kind of person who's putting together this calendar, about when it was in terms of the specific circumstance, and what is important to people. So let's do just that. Let's turn off the lights for a second.
Why wouldn't it be the same?
What would be the same?
The calendar, isn't it?
Great. So why would it be? It could be that there is a calendar which may not be accurate. Could you find a Jewish calendar that would not be accurate? What's that?
If they didn't add
the month. If they didn't add the month, why else would you find a Jewish calendar that would be inaccurate? Right. What if you were writing a Jewish calendar and you didn't know what the day was? Or you didn't have the sufficient rabbinic literature to know, well, how many months have, because Jewish lunar months have either 29 days or 30 days. And that's going to affect your entire cycle. Well, what circumstance could you envision in which somebody might try to put together a calendar without requisite material? So let's turn to our next calendar, and this is a very incredibly fascinating piece. This calendar that you're looking at on the screen, thanks to the Yad Vashem online, is a Jewish calendar that was found, well, it wasn't found, it was donated by a woman who we'll talk about in a second. I want you just to see the name on the top left, if you can see. The back cover says Avraham Hellman, Be Tes Ayin Resh Ayin Zion Yud Ayin Nun Shin Tes Aleph Dalet Samach. That's a ton of letters, which means it's heavily Yiddishized. Be Teresenstadt. Okay? This is the calendar. On the right-hand side, you see the illustration, which we'll talk about who the illustrator was in a minute, when the lights are on. You can see the illustration looks like what? What does it give you a sense of? What's that? That's right, a shul. And the research says this is a sketch of this artist of what it looked like in the shul at Theresienstadt. So what do you see in the top center?
I'm actually going to get over here without holding, without tripping. I'm
telling myself, tiny. So what's this look like?
An
arc or a window. Here you have a menorah. Here you have a pew. On the bottom. So in the stained glass windows or in the synagogue that you'll go to today, you'll often have a quote, a citation, usually in Hebrew. So what would it say? It'd say, know before whom you stand, or, you know, this is the gate of the righteous, etc. What is the title that this artist puts on the bottom of the synagogue? This is incredible. He says, Kol Hamakom Asher Galu, all the places to which the Jews were exiled, Shechina imahem. The divine presence is with them. That is what the artist's rendering of the synagogue in Theresienstadt reminded him of. So let's put on the lights for a second. Kol Makom Shegol. So that is incredible. In the early years of Yad Vashem, let's give the background of this piece. Someone dropped off a calendar, which is this calendar, for the 1943-1944 year. Why do I say 1943 to 1944? That's right, because Rosh Hashanah means it's starting in 43 to 44, which would be the Jewish year 5704. Tuf Shin Dalet. So it starts in Rosh Hashanah. You saw the person who owns this, sounds like, is Avraham Hellman, who came from a... He came from a with his wife. They were in Theresienstadt. He was very involved in the Jewish community. He and his wife were from Germany. His wife survived Theresienstadt. His son and daughter had previously settled in Israel. When he arrived in Theresienstadt, he became very involved in the community. He led the Kol Nidre here in 1944 in Theresienstadt before he was deported to Auschwitz. The artist of this calendar was a man by the name of Asher Berliner. Berliner was an artist who drew other artwork in Auschwitz, in Theresienstadt, which is preserved in the Yad Vashem art collection. He was a prominent Jew in Schweinfurt, Germany, both as a chazan.
Schweinfurt.
That's right, Schweinfurt. Thank you.
I know, I'm very familiar.
Okay. One, for those who are new, for the next year, you will hear a lot of mispronounced words. Because I'm good with English, pretty much, and maybe some Hebrew. A little smattering of Yiddish, not much Polish, certainly not. So, this artist, Asher Berliner, was active in the Jewish community, and he taught art, and he is the artist who created this calendar. He, too, later was going to be deported from Theresienstadt to Auschwitz. As many of you know, most of the people who went to Theresienstadt, that was just a holding camp. They weren't kept there until the end of the war. So this is going to tell us something about Jewish life in Theresienstadt, that it was important enough to these Jews to create a space where they could keep track of the Jewish holidays and of the regular things during the week. Because as you'll see, now let's turn off the lights for a second. Let's go back to the pictures. You'll see this is the artwork. What is the artwork on the left side? It is Luach Lishnas Tuf Shin Dalid, the calendar for the year 5704. And on each of these panels is the Hebrew months with the sign. So Cheshvan is the scorpion, and Tammuz is Cancer, because each Jewish month corresponds to the zodiac. And on the right hand, you see another artistic rendering. But now look on this frame. This is one entry into this calendar. So what does it say on the top? Tammuz, which is the summer month of Tammuz. Mazel Sartan. What do we call that in English? Sartan is cancer. How many days is it this month? Top left, you see where it is? How many days? Chaf Tes. How many is Chaf Tes? 29 days. So that's the first thing. The next line you see, it says Molad. Molad means when is in Jerusalem the new moon going to be seen. So if you go to a synagogue today, if you go to a shul, the Saturday morning, Shabbos morning, before the new month is going to appear, there's a guy who bangs on the thing and he says, the Molad, the appearance of the new moon will be in Jerusalem at such and such a time. So they're tracking it in Theresienstadt. Mittwoch. What is Mittwoch? What day is Mittwoch?
Wednesday,
the 21st of June, 6 hours, 14 minutes, and 8 of 9 portions. That's when you're going to get the new moon. So on the bottom left, you see, he's Yuni going into Yuli, June going into July, and every day, you see at the top, Donnerstag, Freitag, Shabbos, Shin is Shabbos, Sunday, Monday, Dienstag, Mittwoch, etc. First on the left-hand column, I'll come back over here so you can see if you can't see so well. On the left-hand column, you see he's tracking the secular days. So June 22nd, 23rd, 24th corresponds to Shabbos, which is the third day, which they're going to read Parshas Korach, and they're going to read the fourth chapter of Pirkei Avos for those who have the custom of studying ethics of the fathers on Shabbos afternoon. That is mind-blowing. That somebody would take the time in Theresienstadt to record what chapter is in the weekly reading of Pirkei Avos.
So did this come from memory?
Great question. Let's turn on the lights for a second, please. I don't know the answer to that question. Some of it may have come from memory, but the application of it can't come from memory because you have to apply the principles to the contemporary circumstances. So you have to know all the different rules of how to arrange a calendar and then apply them.
But you have to remember which parsha, which...
Oh, okay, great,
like,
yes.
Like,
yes, perfect, so we're going to get to that. Okay, so maybe the third calendar that we're going to look at has an example of an error. We mentioned before there are going to be errors. Well, we have different customs. For example, the difference between Israel and the United States, oftentimes, how to break up the Torah readings. Why? Because some weeks you have double portions and some weeks you have single. So one of the errors that's going to crop up in the last calendar is that they didn't know which week was going to be a double portion, so they were off a little bit. So after the war, this survivor came to the synagogue. Maisa Shoyakaka, he didn't say this, came to the synagogue and was very confused why they were off a Torah reading, because in their calendar that this woman was keeping, So they had to have had a tremendous amount of scholarship to know how to put this calendar together. So I don't know what books they had available to them, because as many of us know, Theresienstadt was certainly different than Death Camp. It was even different than a regular concentration camp, if you can say the word regular, traditional concentration camp. But this is our first calendar. Any, yes, observations?
This is is that somebody might have brought a calendar with them when they came, and then based on that calendar, they continue.
Right. So I don't know the answer. I do know, from what I found from Yad Vashem, that this calendar was kept by Charlotte Hellman, the wife of Avram Hellman, whose name is on the calendar. She kept his belongings, including a chauffeur that he had brought to Theresienstadt, and that he had used in the community that Rosh Hashanah, and she brought it to Israel and donated this calendar to Yad Vashem. So more than that, I don't know. But this is one example. Yes. Yes.
Is that a mathematical calendar?
Yes. That's mathematical. That's fixed and that's set because it's astronomical. It follows the moon's lunar cycle, which is fixed. So you can know what the Molad will be today. You can calculate it for 5 years from now. But that's easy because we have a calendar that we can reference. We have the internet. You can go online and figure out what time the moment is going to be on Rosh Chodesh, because you can go to the Naval Observatory website and figure out what time is sunrise and sunset any given day, for the next in perpetuity.
So
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Either somebody remembered it, right. Somebody wrote it down, or they had a book that they brought with them that they calculated with. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how they did it. Obviously, it's going to get more difficult as we talk in a minute. But the thought that that mattered, that they paid attention to that, is amazing. Let's go to our next calendar, into hiding. This calendar, it's a little bit harder to see because it's kind of faded. This is an image, and you can see, I don't know if you can read the words, digitally adjusted image of the calendar Rabbi Yehoshua Neuwirth, author of Shmira Shabbos Kilchasa, created when he was 17 years old while hiding in a bunker in Amsterdam during the war years. Courtesy of Rabbi and Rebbetzin Yehoshua Neuwirth. By the way, he passed away several years ago after this article was written, where I got this from the Jewish Action, with the assistance of Dr. Esther Farnstein. Let's turn on the lights. In 1939, let's go back. In 1938, at the outbreak of Kristallnacht, in Berlin was living a family by the name of Neuwirth. The father was a rabbi in several German communities, and ultimately in Berlin. And after Kristallnacht, their younger son, by the name of Yehoshua, is sent on a kinder transport. He leaves on the kinder transport, and he goes to Belgium. He observes his bar mitzvah in Belgium with no family. And from Belgium, he travels to Holland. He ends up in Amsterdam. And through a whole series of amazing circumstances, his family, most of them, are able to, he has a brother and a sister. The brother ends up going somewhere else in France, and then one brother is deported to Auschwitz from France. But the parents end up with most of their family in Amsterdam. They get special papers from the Hungarian embassy, which is an amazing thing that they got. And now they're living in hiding in Amsterdam. The father and mother, the son and the daughter. The daughter looks, you'll excuse me for saying it, as he writes in his introduction to his work, Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa, Rabbi Neuwirth published this important work. He writes that his sister did not look Jewish. So they had her go out on the street, and she was able to get a hold of some food and some various items, and she made contact with the underground, the Jewish underground and the Dutch underground. Meanwhile, eventually, she stops going out. She was working for a particular family, and it was a challenge for her to observe Shabbos, so the parents decided she should rather stay at home. And they go inside their apartment, and that's where they stay. Through a miraculous, as he describes, miraculous set of circumstances, they avoid detection by the Germans in the initial roundup of Jews. As we know, most of those Dutch Jews went to Westerbork, and then they either went to Auschwitz or Bergen-Belsen. They avoid detection, and even in the most intense deportations of 1943, they still avoid detection. He describes, Rabbi Neuwirth wrote this very important book about the laws of Shabbos. He describes that he cannot attribute it to anything else than godly intervention, that there was one particular man in their building who did not particularly care for Jews. And he didn't care for them either. He said the Germans came for one roundup in their courtyard, and they were going house to house, apartment to apartment. But to their apartment building, they didn't go upstairs. They just banged on the door downstairs, and they said, "Are there any Jews here?" And this Dutch Gentile yelled out, "No Jews here." And they left. So here is this young man, this teenager, who's stuck in an apartment. He describes that he could not... They were fed, they got some food by the underground, by the resistance, they dropped off food with them. They could not leave the apartment. And not only could they not leave the apartment, he says they could not go near the window. So he spent 3 years in an apartment with no access to the outside world. He couldn't even go near the window. What did he have? So he studied with his father. He had a tractate called Masechet Ksibos. He had a volume of law relating to the laws of Shabbos, which is why he later published this important work on the laws of Shabbos. Today, if you go to a rabbinic talk, on the laws of Shabbos that's practical. You must quote this volume, Shmir Shabbos Tosa, it's ubiquitous. And he had what's called the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is a small compendium of Jewish law. From this small compendium of Jewish law, he set out to create his own private calendar, which he did, which is what you're looking at on the stage. This teenager makes a Jewish calendar, which then gets passed to the underground and copied for other Jews living and hiding in Amsterdam, so that everybody could follow the Jewish calendar. So that they all knew when's Pesach. So he describes in this introduction to the Shemir Shabbos that the partisans dropped off a bag of potatoes at their door the week before Pesach, so that they could have kosher for Passover food. They should have potatoes for a week. And that they dropped off some flour, and his mother baked, you can imagine, I don't know how many matzahs she baked, and they were sent them back through the underground out to other Jews in Amsterdam so that they could observe Pesach. But how could you observe Pesach? But they had a calendar. Because if you don't have a calendar, you don't know when to observe Pesach. Everything falls apart. And let's go to one last calendar, which you'll look at here. Let's turn off the light for 1 second. And while we're turning out the lights, let's pass around these articles. Thank you. This is going to be your take-home gift. And I want to express tremendous hakaras hatov to my friend, Dr. David Shaivitz. Dr. Shaivitz is a professor in Northwestern, and I had a hard time getting a hold of this article. So I reached out to him. I said, could you do me a favor through your, I assume this is, no, legal, he's not doing anything nefarious. So through your academic contacts, could you please get me this article, which is an absolutely amazing work. And in this article, the author, whose name is Alan Rosen, who is a Holocaust scholar and expert and a teacher in Yad Vashem, he has an article called Tracking Jewish Time in Auschwitz. Yeah, there's more. So this article, which you'll take home, includes this page from the Jewish calendar of Sophie Solberg. Sophie Solberg is a woman who arrives in Auschwitz and is sent to work in the laundry. So she has relatively better conditions than those who were working in hard labor in Birkenau, but, or Monowitz, or Auschwitz III, but still not so simple. This tiny little Jewish calendar is the calendar that she made when she was working in Auschwitz, that she kept with her through the death march from Auschwitz until she was liberated. So let's turn on the light. So this article, Tracking Jewish Time in Auschwitz, by Alan Rosen, focuses on multiple calendars. Two calendars specifically written in Auschwitz. We're focusing just on one. You can read it when you get home. And it's actually, I found out that he is working on a book. This is going to become a full book. I think it's called Killing Time. That's the tentative title. It's due out in 2019. So you can't get it yet. But he is a man who is on a mission, not just to educate about the Holocaust, but to educate people about the role that Jewish calendars played for Jews in their personal resistance during the Holocaust in different contexts. So it's one thing to make a calendar in Haydn. It's another thing to make a calendar in Theresienstadt. It's a totally other thing to make a calendar in Auschwitz. Right? It's unbelievable. So in this article, he gives you the history of this woman, Sophie Solberg. This woman, when she was a teenager, her parents sent her to something called Hakshara. What's Hakshara? It was kind of like a... Right, a girl's... not just for girls, it's for men and for women.
Preparation to go to Israel and work on the kibbutz.
That's right. Preparation to go to Israel, work on the kibbutz, and they had these in several places in Germany for Jewish youngsters. And she went to this Hakshara. Yes, please.
That's very interesting. Because the Jews in Europe were so intellectual, so different Hakshara Chabot were created in different places in Germany, where young Jewish people were sent to learn manual trades because Jews were not used to working with their hands. And this was in preparation for when they would end up in Israel, they should be able to work with their hands. So that's what the Hakshara was. And it wasn't necessarily agriculture. For the girl to put in housekeeping, it could be in the seamstress, it could be in the cook. But the idea was that you worked with their hands.
Mm-hmm.
That's how Hakshara was.
And it wasn't just in Germany. My late grandfather, Oliver Shalom, he emigrated to this country as a young boy from Galicia, and their family, my family, our tradition, we are Hasidic Zionist. That's right. Galicianer Hasidic religious Zionist, Mizrahi, from their shtetl. So when he came to America, he and a group of friends actually got a piece of land in New Jersey where they practiced farming, and then, without telling his parents and forging their signatures, he got a ticket on a steamship to go to what was that at that time Palestine in 1932. So the concept of Hakshara, so this young woman was on Hakshara, and there she met another group of girls, including a subset of those girls were religious girls. So when they were there, they banded together, and they not only observed their Yiddishkeit, their Judaism, but they also studied, and they learned. And from the studies that this girl had in Hakshara, she was able to construct a Jewish calendar in Auschwitz. It's mind-boggling. It's mamash, totally unbelievable. That she's working in the laundromat, that she has a best friend, it describes, that she had a very close friend with whom she shared a chumash. Remember, their conditions were different. Relatively, they were better than those who were working in the slave labor. So they had a chumash. The chumash was ultimately found and confiscated, but they would learn chumash every week. So their calendar, she's going to keep track of what parasha it is, what day it is, what holiday it is. And that's what I mentioned before. She has one blip. Professor Rosen notes that she has one blip in the calendar where she's off a parasha because of a double parasha and a skip. But she was so committed to her Jewish life that she was going to keep studying the Torah portion with this friend of hers who she met in the laundromat. And the way that she was going to do that was by keeping her calendar. So, now we can address kind of the key takeaways, things that we can think about in terms of what it means to keep time. Obviously, number one, it was very important for many people to keep time, although this is only a small sampling of what probably existed. One of the things that Professor Rosen notes in this article is that we have very few calendars from early on in the war. So why is that? Probably because they were all either lost or destroyed. So the calendars that we have in Auschwitz are from 1944. If somebody arrived in Auschwitz in 1941, it's very unlikely that their calendars survived. So there may have been many more calendars that people were keeping in various ways. We just don't have a lot of them. We don't have, you know, the physical evidence of them. But we have this snapshot. The other interesting thing we see from this sketch of three calendars that we're talking about today is that it spans an interesting gap. You have rabbis and rabbi sons, men, you have average everyday people, and then you have women. Everybody is interested in keeping the calendar. It's not one. These are examples of multiple perspectives, multiple backgrounds. It's not just the rabbi put together a calendar, although there is also evidence that in Bergen-Belsen there were Dutch Jews, one of the Dutch rabbis in Bergen-Belsen, who put together a calendar. But it's not just rabbis. Everyday people, men and women. And this speaks to the significance, and this is what we're going to focus on for the remainder of our time, which is, what is the significance of these calendars on a deep level? Right? Beyond the practicality of knowing, well, when is Shabbos? And you'll notice that, he points out in the article, there's no Shabbos candlelighting time. There's no candlelighting. There's no candles, there's no candlelighting. But beyond the practical of, I want to observe Yom Rosh Hashanah, I want to observe Pesach, I want to know when is Shabbos. What's that?
Connection.
Resistance. Right? Resistance, a specific form of spiritual resistance. Yeah, what else?
It's also a measure of structure and like creating a normality and situation.
Okay, so
Jewish
there's structure,
normalcy.
Jewish normalcy,
right,
and the concept of creating. Who's creating the calendar? Who's owning the time?
Everyone who's in charge.
That's right.
Who's in charge
of the time? Who owns the time? So this relates to three insights, three layers that we can consider about time. Powerful insights about time, Jewish time, that may be beneath the power of these calendars and certainly affects us how we think about time today. And the first one is the idea of time as an opportunity in terms of resistance. I'll explain what I mean. This volume is called Festival of Freedom, Essays on Pesach and the Haggadah, collected from the manuscripts of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik is one of the preeminent rabbinic scholars of the 20th century. He grew up in a rabbinic, let's say, elite of the elite, the greatest rabbinic families, the Brisker family, the Soloveitchik family. His tradition is very strong, and he was one of the greatest giants. So after he died, in his home in Boston, there were scores of manuscripts, pages and pages of manuscripts that were published posthumously in these lectures. Here, he has a section, and this is about Pesach, so it has to do with slavery and liberation, which of course now has a specific resonance with our discussion. Time is of critical importance, not years or months, but seconds and split seconds. This time awareness and appreciation is the singular gift granted to free man, because time belongs to him. It is his time, and he can utilize it to the utmost or waste it. A free man does not want time to pass. He wants time to slow down, because to him, time is a treasure. To the slave, however, time is a curse. He waits for the day to pass. How many memoirs have we read where a survivor will write how they waited for the morning to come and then they waited for the night to come? That's a curse that is to the word of Mitzvah. For Erev Tomar, Miyitin Boker. In the evening, people will say, who can't wait for the morning? And Boker Yomar, Miyitin Erev, who can't wait for the evening? The slave's time is the property of his master. No matter how hard he may try to be productive in his time, he will not reap the harvest of his work. Therefore, he is insensitive to time. His sense of movement of time, the passing of hours, days, the week, is very dull. Life to the slave personality is motionless. That's why he explains a slave is not connected to time-bound commandments. Because he has no concept of time. Unlike women, who are connected to time and have a different reason why they are disconnected from time-bound positive commandments, there's a fundamental reason. So what happens when somebody says, I am going to create a calendar? Not just a calendar that is a secular calendar so I know what day of October it is, but I'm going to create a Jewish calendar. What are they saying with that?
I'm not a slave.
I'm connecting myself to the commandments because I'm going to create some meaning. I'm going to create freedom for myself within the servitude that exists around me. That's resistance. That's spiritual and emotional resistance. That's one level. Rav Soloveitchik has another essay in a different context. This is published in the 70s in a publication called Gesher, in an essay entitled Sacred and Profane. This essay talks about Kodesh, sacred, and breaks down into two segments. Kedushas Makom, sanctity of place, and Kedushas Zman, sanctity of time. So in the context of time, which is very lengthy, which we're not going to take the time for today, but I'm happy to send it to you if you'd like. It's not the easiest thing to get a hold of, but for you, we can. We may then say then that qualitative time consciousness is comprised of two elements. First, the appreciation of the enormous implications inherent in the fleeting moments of time. No fraction of time, however infinite, should slip through the fingers left unexploited, for eternity may depend on the brief moment. That's the first observation, and that's similar to what he says
in this volume about Pesach and slavery and slaves. But then it goes on. Secondly, the vicarious experience while in the present of the past and the future. No distance, however removed, should separate one's time consciousness from the dawn of one's group or from the eschatological destiny and the infinite realization of one's cherished ideals. Meaning, when we sit down to the Seder, which is an appointed time, we don't view that Seder as disconnected from last year's Seder. Where time for Jews moves in a circle, in a cycle. It's going around cyclically. So every year we start here, and then we come around, we come back at the same geographic location in time. Not really, it's not geography, but it's the same date on the calendar, but in a different place in our life. And then the next year we're in a different place. And the next year, so we're coming back to the same Seder, but we're connecting to all the previous Seders. So time, in this respect, creates a transcendent quality. It means you connect to your past and you connect to your future, your destiny. Even though it's on a calendar, but what that marker on the calendar is saying is, I'm back at Pesach again. Well, what is the Pesach experience for me? I'm back at Purim again. I'm back at Rosh Hashanah again. Well, that Rosh Hashanah is the same Rosh Hashanah as connected to all the prior Rosh Hashanahs. My parents' Rosh Hashanah. My grandparents' Rosh Hashanah. My grandchildren's Rosh Hashanah. There's a continuity that exists through Jewish time, which is framed, physically framed on a calendar. But what that means is that when you create a calendar and you observe, even if you do nothing for Rosh Hashanah, you don't have a shofar, you don't have matzah, but you have the point of contact with that time, and that time is transcendent. So now you're not within the confines of an Auschwitz barrack. You're back with your grandparents and your Seder table as a child. All the Jews everywhere. You're expanded, yes.
Because
that would create rabbi, more different kind of behavior. They know that the future will be what survives,
it's going to be the future, the future. So there is an element of hopefulness that you're alluding to. Yes, John. A couple of points. Celebration is one of the key issues that keeps us as a group will survive for scores of millennia. It has been said, and I heard it said, and that the reason that the Jews are here is because of our calendar. We're here when every other people of the world that existed in ancient times are gone. They didn't keep time. They had no idea what one day from another day to a third day or what day of this country would be this year meant. I don't know how they did that, but they knew in ancient times these dates, these significant dates, which was important, even though the Purim came, you know, let's say in the 5th century. Who ever heard of Purim before the 5th century or 6th century, whatever the verses were on? Did we hear about Purim in the 1st century? I doubt it, but we didn't know. But we had a way of knowing that the days that we did celebrate were so unique, so unique, that we kept those days, and that kept us as a people.
Yes, I want to come back to that one second, but first, why don't we give you a floor?
The festivals, it's, there's somebody that says not just the Jewish people kept Shabbos, and Shabbos that kept the Jewish
that's
people.
Right.
And so that's a big...
Huge.
So beyond festivals, it's the weekly cycle.
Yes, so I would say yes and to both of those. Do you know who makes your point? The author of the prior calendar, Rabbi... What's that? We're going to get to Heschel in 1 minute. All right. Oh, you stole the thunder.
Sorry.
Unbelievable.
Sorry.
I'm just going to give it up.
Sorry.
I don't even need it. You should just do this yourself. What do you need me for? We'll get to Heschel in 1 second, but I want to go on that point for 1 second. We mentioned the author of that second calendar, Rabbi Neuwirth. So Rabbi Neuwirth wrote this volume called Shmiras Shabbos Kilchasa, Observing Shabbos Appropriately, the proper way to observe Shabbos, and it's a list of laws.
In the introduction to that volume, he says, you know what has kept the Jews together from time immemorial? Is the observance of time through Shabbos. He says that's why there's a rabbinic tradition that actually, this is the tradition, that Moshe went to Pharaoh and he says, Pharaoh, you work these guys 7 days a week, they're going to drop them. They won't work. Even the concentration camps, by the way, they didn't have seven work days. They had six work days, and then they had Sunday kind of like a different schedule. Because nobody can work 7 days. But what was Moshe saying to Pharaoh? Give us the day. We're going to take a vacation for a day so we can marshal our strength. What is he saying to the Jews? We're going to have one day we'll all be on the same page. And that, he says, the ability to mark time is what kept... It's exactly what he says. This rabbinic giant, Yoram Mechavan, he says exactly that point, that specifically talks about Shabbos, but of course it's true for all the Yom Tovin, but Shabbos, the Gemara says, is Kviya V'Kaima, it's set. And that is a marker that is universal. And no matter where you are in the world, and no matter what they can strip away from you, they can't take away your observance of Shabbos. They can force you to work, but you can still have Shabbos inside yourself. So that is the glue, he's saying. So we talk about transcendence and over previous generations, even on a practical level. If we didn't have a Jewish calendar, there's, you know, one of the challenges of the Hellenists in the Hanukkah period was about setting the calendar. Because without a Jewish calendar, everything falls apart. So let's get to one last point. Yeah, Mickey, before I finish. Yeah.
Observation/question.
Yes.
And I think sometimes, like, when we talk about in the ghetto, so we talk about them going to school and they were planning for the future and that, but we've also talked about the fact that there were times that they didn't even know that the Jewish people were going to survive. Like, they had no, during the Holocaust, they had no connection to the outside world. They saw what was going on around them, and they really, there were those that believed this was the end of the Jewish people. And so, based on that, this is observation question mark. Is this also we need to, like, preserve in case somebody survives? We need to write a calendar so that the glue, the traditions, the like, all of that, if I don't make it, maybe my little piece of paper makes it, maybe my calendar.
It's a good question. I don't know enough to say. All I could say is it would seem to me that this is more in terms of how I can live in the moment. You know, if you want to think about what you would give to future generations and put in a can, right? Would you put a calendar? Would you make a calendar? You would probably write down, you know, other things. Look at what they were burying in the Onik Shabbos archives, or, you know, the calendar has a very specific function. So to me, more than being about burying it for somebody who's going to survive, it's about what kind of experience I'm going to create for myself in the here and now. So now let's finish with the Heschel observation, which is the crux of this volume called The Sabbath, where Heschel introduces sanctity of place and says, without any disrespect to sanctity of place, it's really all about the sanctity of time. Indeed, we do know what to do with space, but do not know what to do about time, except to make it subservient to space. Most of us seem to labor for the sake of things of space. As a result, we suffer from a deeply rooted dread of time and stand aghast when compelled to look into its face. Because we're coming from a place of things, of possessions, of places. What is time all about? It's about something else entirely. And that when we focus on time, it brings us to a different realm, a different dimension of our lives. Time to us, he says, here. The higher goal of spiritual living is not to amass a wealth of information, but to face sacred moments. In a religious experience, for example, it is not a thing that imposes itself on man, but a spiritual presence. Our intention here is not to deprecate the world of space that God gave us. What we plead against is man's unconditional surrender to space. That's not what gives things significance. It is the moment that lends significance to things. To things. Meaning, it's this opportunity, it is this time that we
interact with God. Yes, it is true, there is something called Kedushas Makom, there is sanctity of place. But he says, much more ubiquitous, at least, for sure, because you can observe Shabbos wherever you are. You can't observe the laws of the sanctity of the temple in Skokie. He says, this idea of transcending the physical limitations of space and things can be felt and found in the dimension of time. And that's why Shabbos and Yom Tov are such magical, spectacular beacons of energy, because that is the interaction that we have with godliness and with meaning. Meaning comes through that dimension of time. Get to 1 second. So whereas the Germans could take people away from their place and put them in a different place, they could take away their possessions, their things, they cannot take away time. They cannot take away a moment. And so what people choose to do with their moment and how they create meaning out of that moment, no one could take that away. And so by creating a calendar, what you're doing is you are demarcating those moments. And you're saying, that moment is still special. I can't eat matzah, but it's still my matzah moment. I can still connect with godliness, with my tradition, with my family, with my community, all in this construct of a calendar. And so I think on these three levels, the level of opportunity to create those opportunities, on the level of transcendence, beyond just the moment that we're in, the past and the future, and also the creation of meaning, is why the idea of the calendar is so profound. And these few examples that we have still extant give us a window into that spiritual resistance that the people had in terms of seeking out and creating that meaning for themselves in these indescribable circumstances. So I encourage you to enjoy this article on your own. I thank you for coming and look forward to... Yes, last two comments, please.
I only have one comment.
Yes.
We need to spend more time.
Yes. We spend too much time on things and not enough time on time.
No, I mean, even taking that subject that you...
Yes, focusing on it, right.
And spending more time because it's almost endless.
Right. Yes.
I have a simple question. I'm sure others perhaps know this. We've been talking about time and calendar and significance in terms of survival, history, and whatever.
Yes.
What is the rationale behind observance of holidays between, say, the diaspora and Galut versus Israel? Is it because of the time element of the age?
Oh, great. So, it's a loaded question. The question is, why is there a discrepancy between the experience of the festivals on the calendar in Israel versus the festivals outside? So there's a technical answer, and then there's probably also a very profound spiritual answer. The technical answer is that initially, they did not have, in the Jewish tradition, the concept of a calendar. Every month, the rabbinical court in Jerusalem, initially it was in Jerusalem, had to fix the calendar for that month. Which, by the way, only heightens our appreciation for time, because it makes us realize that God, in the ideal, wants us to own our lives every month. You can't just put time on autopilot. Talk about focus on time. And you know how they had to think about it? They would say, well, wait a second. How rainy is it this time of year? Is it going to be a problem for people to get to Passover in Israel? Are there going to be too many seats on the plane? Not enough seats? They're going to have goats? They're not going to have goats? Well, we're going to navigate it. They were very sensitive to time. Today, we're not so sensitive. I'm not sensitive to time. I look on the app. Whenever it says Shabbos starts, Shabbos starts. Whenever it says sundown is, I daven mincha. When it's nighttime, I daven maariv. Like, ha. If God forbid I was in a situation when I needed to create a calendar, I would have no idea what to do. I would have no idea. Because it's not something that I'm sensitive to, because I'm spoiled and I have it all put on the calendar on the wall. So in the ancient times, they fixed the calendar every month. The challenge became how to communicate what the fixed month time was to the people who were living far away. So they had various, the Mishnaic tradition has various methods. They used to have bonfires at night to tell everybody when it was the first of the month. From the mountaintops, and then that got messed up, and they had people going on horseback. But eventually they said, you know what? If you're going to observe the first day of the month of Tishrei,
people, it's going to take them 3 weeks to get to, you know, wherever your Yakutsk or Irkutsk, wherever the risk names you're going to put on those far-flung places that we don't have anymore. It's going to take too long. So they're going to observe what's called misafik, out of doubt. They didn't know, was the prior month 29 days or 30 days? And that is the origin of how that practice developed. And then it became codified that in Israel, you were close to the action, you knew when the day was going to be, you observe, as it says in the Torah, Passover 7 days, Sukkah 7 days, that's it. But if you're outside, you wouldn't know. Once there was a fixed calendar, the Talmud asks, why do we keep 2 days? It's a tradition, and we keep that tradition. The Talmud says, what happens if, God forbid, somebody is in a situation where they don't know what it's going to be? Shema yachzar adavar l'kulkulo. Well, it's amazing that there actually were situations in history where Jews were disconnected and they wouldn't necessarily have easy access to a calendar. So that's why that explains the discrepancy between Israel and outside of Israel.